air. His sneakers in the air, and his warm-up pants sagging upward to reveal black socks. There's been a bad sound of glass. Penn flails on his back. Postlethwaite, Ingersoll, and McKenna bleed. The second shift's 1600-hour siren down at Sunstrand Power and Light is creepily muffled by the no sound of falling snow. The 8th of November, year of the Depend Adult Undergarment, Interdependence Day. Boston AA is like AA nowhere else on this planet. Just like AA everyplace else, Boston AA is divided into numerous individual AA groups, and each group has its particular group name, like the Reality Group, or the Alston Group, or the Clean and Sober Group, and each group holds its regular meeting once a week. But almost all Boston groups' meetings are speaker meetings. That means that at the meetings there are recovering alcoholic speakers who stand up in front of everybody at an amplified podium and share their experience, strength, and hope.
131.
And the singular thing is that these speakers are not ever members of the group that's holding the meeting in Boston. The speakers at one certain group's weekly speaker meeting are always from some other certain Boston AA group. The people from the other group who are here at, like, your group speaking are here on something called a commitment. Commitments are where some members of one group commit to hit the road and travel to another group's meeting to speak publicly from the podium. Then a bunch of people from the host group hit the opposite lane of the same road on some other night and go to the visiting group's meeting to speak. Groups always trade commitments. You come speak to us, and we'll come speak to you. It can seem bizarre. You always go elsewhere to speak. At your own group's meeting, you're a host. You just sit there and listen as hard as you can, and you make coffee in 60-cup urns and stack polystyrene cups and big ziggurats and sell raffle tickets and make sandwiches, and you empty ashtrays and scrub out urns and sweep floors when the other group's speakers are through. You never share your experience, strength, and hope on stage behind a fiberboard podium with its cheap, non-digital PA systems mic, except in front of some other Metro Boston group.
132.
Every night in Boston, bumper-stickered cars full of totally sober people, wall-eyed from caffeine and trying to read illegibly scrawled directions by the dashboard lights, crisscross the city, heading for the church basements or bingo halls or nursing home cafeterias of other AA groups to put on commitments. Being an active member of a Boston AA group is probably a little bit like being a serious musician or like athlete in terms of constant travel. The White Flag Group of Enfield, Massachusetts and Metropolitan Boston meets Sundays in the cafeteria of the Provident Nursing Home on Hanneman Street, off Commonwealth Avenue, a couple blocks west of Enfield Tennis Academy's flat-topped hill. Tonight, the White Flag Group is hosting a commitment from the Advanced Basics Group of Concord, a suburb of Boston. The Advanced Basics people have driven almost an hour to get here. Plus, there's always the problem of signless urban streets and directions given over the phone. On this coming Friday night, a small horde of White Flaggers will drive out to Concord to put on a reciprocal commitment for the Advanced Basics Group. Traveling long distances on signless streets, trying to parse directions like, take the second left off the rotary by the driveway to the chiropractors, and getting lost and shooting your whole evening after a long day just to speak for like 6 minutes at a plywood podium, is called getting active with your group. The speaking itself is known as 12th step work, or giving it away. Giving it away is a cardinal Boston AA principle. The terms derive from an epigrammatic description of recovery in Boston AA. You give it up to get it back, to give it away. Sobriety in Boston is regarded as less a gift than a sort of cosmic loan. You can't pay the loan back, but you can pay it forward. By spreading the message that despite all appearances, AA works, spreading this message to the next new guy who's tottered in to a meeting and is sitting in the back row, unable to hold his cup of coffee. The only way to hang on to sobriety is to give it away. And even just 24 hours of sobriety is worth doing anything for, a sober day being nothing short of a daily miracle if you've got the disease like he's got the disease, says the Advanced Basics member, who's chairing this evening's commitment, saying just a couple public words to the hall before he opens the meeting and retires to a stool next to the podium and calls his group's speakers by random lot. The chairperson says he didn't used to be able to go 24 lousy minutes without a nip before he came in. Coming in means admitting that your personal ass is kicked and tottering into Boston AA, ready to go to any lengths to stop the shitstorm. The Advanced Basics chairperson looks like a perfect cross between pictures of Dick Cavett and Truman Capote.
133.
Except this guy's also like totally, almost flamboyantly, bald. And to top it off, he's wearing a bright black country western shirt with baroque curlicues of white noty piping across the chest and shoulders, and a string tie, plus sharp-toed boots of some sort of weirdly imbricate reptile skin. And overall, he's riveting to look at, grotesque in that riveting way that flaunts its grotesquery. There are more cheap metal ashtrays and styrofoam cups in this broad hall than you'll see anywhere else ever on Earth. Gately's sitting right up front in the first row, so close to the podium he can see the tailor's notch and the chairperson's outsized incisors. But he enjoys twisting around and watching everybody come in and mill around, shaking water off their outerwear, trying to find empty seats. Even on the night of the Interdependence Day holiday, the Providence cafeteria is packed by 2,000 hours. AA does not take holidays any more than the disease does. This is the big established Sunday PM meeting for AAs in Enfield and Alston and Brighton. Regulars come every week from Watertown and East Newton, too, often, unless they're out on commitments with their own groups. The Provident cafeteria walls, painted an indecisive green, are tonight bedecked with portable felt banners emblazoned with AA slogans in Cub Scoutish blue and gold. The slogans on them appear way too insipid even to mention what they are. For example, "One day at a time," for one. The effete Western-dressed guy concludes his opening exhortation, leads the opening moment of silence, reads the AA preamble, pulls a random name out of the crested Butte cowboy hat he's holding, makes a squinty show of reading it, says he'd like to call Advanced Basics first random speaker of the evening, and asks if his fellow group member, John L., is in the house here tonight. John L. gets up to the podium and says, "That is a question I did not use to be able to answer." This gets a laugh, and everybody's posture gets subtly more relaxed, because it's clear that John L. has some sober time in and isn't going to be one of those AA speakers who's so racked with self-conscious nerves he makes the empathetic audience nervous too. Everybody in the audience is aiming for total empathy with the speaker. That way they'll be able to receive the AA message he's here to carry. Empathy, in Boston AA, is called identification. Then John L. says his first name and what he is, and everybody calls hello. White Flag is one of the area AA meetings Ennett House requires its residents to attend. You have to be seen at a designated AA or NA meeting every single night of the week, or out you go, discharged. A house staff member has to accompany the residents when they go to the designated meetings, so they can be officially seen there.
134.
The residents' house counselor suggests that they sit right up at the front of the hall where they can see the pores in the speaker's nose and try to identify instead of compare. Again, identify means empathize. Identifying, unless you've got a stake in comparing, isn't very hard to do here. Because if you sit up front and listen hard, all the speaker's stories of decline and fall and surrender are basically alike, and like your own. Fun with the substance, then very gradually less fun, then significantly less fun because of like blackouts you suddenly come out of on the highway going 145 kilometers per hour with companions you do not know. Nights you awake from in unfamiliar bedding next to somebody who doesn't even resemble any known sort of mammal. 3-day blackouts you come out of and have to buy a newspaper to even know what town you're in. Yes, gradually less and less actual fun, but with some physical need for the substance now instead of the former voluntary fun. Then at some point, suddenly, just very little fun at all, combined with terrible daily hand-trembling need. Then dread, anxiety, irrational phobias, dim siren-like memories of fun, trouble with assorted authorities, knee-buckling headaches, mild seizures, and the litany of what Boston AA calls losses. Then come the day I lost my job to drinking, concords John L., has a huge hanging gut, and just no ass at all. The way some big older guys' asses seem to get sucked into their body and reappear out front as gut. Gately, in sobriety, does nightly sit-ups, out of fear this will all of a sudden happen to him, as age 30 approaches. Gately is so huge no one sits behind him for several rows. John L. has the biggest bunch of keys Gately's ever seen. They're on one of those pull-outable wire janitor's keychains that clips to a belt loop, and the speaker jangles them absently, unaware, his one tip of the hat to public nerves. He's also wearing gray janitor's pants. "Lost my damn job," he says. "I mean to say I still knew where it was and whatnot. I just went in as usual one day, and there was some other fella doing it," which gets another laugh. Then, more losses, with the substance seeming like the only consolation against the pain of the mounting losses. And of course, you're in denial about it being the substance that's causing the very losses it's consoling you about. "The alcohol destroys slowly but thoroughly," is what a fella said to me the first night I come in up in Concord, and that fella ended up becoming my sponsor. Then less mild seizures, DTs during attempts to taper off too fast, introduction to subjective bugs and rodents, then one more binge and more formicative bugs, then eventually a terrible acknowledgement that some line has been undeniably crossed, and, fist at the sky, as God is my witness vows, to buckle down and lick this thing for good, to quit for all time, then maybe a few white-knuckled days of initial success, then a slip, then more pledges, clock-watching, baroque self-regulations, repeated slips back into the substance's relief after like 2 days' abstinence, ghastly hangovers, head-flattening guilt and self-disgust, superstructures of additional self-regulations, for example, not before 0900 hours, not on a work night, only when the moon is waxing, only in the company of Swedes, which also fail. "When I was drunk, I wanted to get sober. And when I was sober, I wanted to get drunk," John L. says. "I lived that way for years. And I submit to you that that's not living. That's a fucking death in life." Then unbelievable psychic pain. A kind of peritonitis of the soul. Psychic agony. Fear of impending insanity. "Why can't I quit if I so want to quit unless I'm insane?" Appearances at hospital detoxes and rehabs, domestic strife, financial freefall, eventual domestic losses. "And then I lost my wife to drinking. I mean, I still knew where she was and whatnot. I just went in one day and there was some other fella doing it." At which there's not all that much laughter. Lots of pained nods. It's often the same all over in terms of domestic losses. Then vocational ultimatums. Unemployability. Financial ruin. Pancreatitis. Overwhelming guilt. Bloody vomiting. Cirrhotic neuralgia. Incontinence. Neuropathy. Nephritis. Black depressions. Searing pain. With the substance affording increasingly brief periods of relief. Then, finally, no relief available anywhere at all. Finally, it's impossible to get high enough to freeze what you feel like being this way. And now, you hate the substance. Hate it. But you still find yourself unable to stop doing it, the substance. You find you finally want to stop more than anything on earth, and it's no fun doing it anymore, and you can't believe you ever liked doing it, but you still can't stop. It's like you're totally fucking bats. It's like there's two yous. And when you'd sell your own dear mum to stop and still you find can't stop, then the last layer of jolly, friendly mask comes off your old friend, the substance. It's midnight now, and all masks come off, and you all of a sudden see the substance as it really is. For the first time you see the disease as it really is, really has been all this time. You look in the mirror at midnight and see what owns you, what's become what you are. A fucking living death. I tell you, it's not being near alive. By the end, I was undead, not alive. And I tell you, the idea of dying was nothing compared to the idea of living like that for another 5 or 10 years, and only then dying. With audience heads nodding in rows like a wind-swept meadow. Boy, can they ever identify. And then you're in serious trouble. Very serious trouble, and you know it, finally. Deadly serious trouble. Because this substance you thought was your one true friend, that you gave up all for gladly, that for so long gave you relief from the pain of the losses your love of that relief caused, your mother and lover and God and compadre, has finally removed its smiley face mask to reveal centerless eyes and a ravening maw and canines down to here. It's the face in the floor. The grinning, root-white face of your worst nightmares. And the face is your own face in the mirror now. It's you. The substance has devoured or replaced and become you. And the puke, drool, and substance-crusted T-shirt you've both worn for weeks now gets torn off, and you stand there looking, and in the root-white chest where your heart, given away to it, should be beating, in its exposed chest's center and centerless eyes, is just a lightless hole, more teeth, and a beckoning taloned hand dangling something irresistible. And now you see you've been had, screwed, royal, stripped and fucked and tossed to the side like some stuffed toy to lie for all time in the posture you land in. You see now that it's your enemy and your worst personal nightmare, and the trouble it's gotten you into is undeniable, and you still can't stop. Doing the substance now is like attending black mass, but you still can't stop, even though the substance no longer gets you high. You are, as they say, finished. You cannot get drunk, and you cannot get sober. You cannot get high, and you cannot get straight. You are behind bars. You are in a cage and can see only bars in every direction. You are in the kind of a hell of a mess that either ends lives or turns them around. You are at a fork in the road that Boston AA calls your bottom. Though the term is misleading, because everybody here agrees it's more like someplace very high and unsupported. You're on the edge of something tall and leaning way out forward. If you listen for the similarities, all these speakers' substance careers seem to terminate at the same cliff's edge. You are now finished as a substance user. It's the jumping-off place. You now have two choices. You can either eliminate your own map for keeps. Blades are the best, or else pills. Or there's always quietly sucking off the exhaust pipe of your repossessable car in the bank-owned garage of your family-less home. Something whimpery instead of banging. Better clean and quiet, and, since your whole career has been one long futile flight from pain, painless. Though of the alcoholics and drug addicts who compose over 70% of a given year's suicides, some try to go out with a last, great, garish, balaclavan gesture. One longtime member of the White Flag group is a prognathist lady named Louise B., who tried to take a map-eliminating drive off the old Hancock building downtown in BS 81, but got caught in the gust of a rising thermal only 6 flights off the roof and got blown cartwheeling back up and in through the smoked glass window of an arbitrage firm's suite on the 34th floor, ending up sprawled prone on a high-gloss conference table with only lacerations and a compound of the collarbone, and an experience of willed self-annihilation and external intervention that has left her rabidly Christian. Rabidly, as in foam. So that she's comparatively ignored and avoided, though her AA story, being just like everybody else's but more spectacular, has become Metro Boston AA myth. But so, when you get to this jumping-off place at the finish of your substance career, you can either take up the Luger or Blade and eliminate your own personal map. This can be at age 60 or 27 or 17. Or you can get out the very beginning of the Yellow Pages or Internet Psych Service file and make a blubbery 0200 phone call and admit to a gentle, grandparentish voice that you're in trouble, deadly serious trouble. And the voice will try to soothe you into hanging on until a couple hours go by, and two pleasantly earnest, weirdly calm guys in conservative attire appear, smiling at your door, sometime before dawn, and speak quietly to you for hours, and leave you not remembering anything from what they said except the sense that they used to be eerily like you, just where you are, utterly fucked. And but now, somehow, aren't anymore. Fucked like you. At least they didn't seem like they were. Unless the whole thing's some incredibly involved scam, this AA thing. And so, but anyway, you sit there on what's left of your furniture in the lavender dawn light and realize that by now you literally have no other choices besides trying this AA thing or else eliminating your map. So you spend the day killing every last bit of every substance you've got in one last joyless, bitter, farewell binge, and resolve, the next day, to go ahead and swallow your pride and maybe your common sense too, and try these meetings of this program that at best is probably just Unitarian happy horse shit, and at worst is a cover for some glazed and canny cult-type thing. Well, they'll keep you sober by making you spend 20 hours a day selling cellophane cones of artificial flowers on the median strips of heavy flow roads. And what defines this cliffish nexus of exactly 2 total choices, this miserable road fork Boston AA calls your bottom, is that at this point you feel like maybe selling flowers on median strips might not be so bad. Not compared to what you've got going, personally, at this juncture. And this, at root, is what unites Boston AA. It turns out this same resigned, miserable, brainwash and exploit me if that's what it takes type desperation has been the jumping-off place for just about every AA you meet, it emerges. Once you've actually gotten it up to stop darting in and out of the big meetings and start walking up with your wet hand out and trying to actually personally meet some Boston AAs. As the one particular tough old guy or lady you're always particularly scared of and drawn to says, nobody ever comes in because things were going really well and they just wanted to round out their PM social calendar. Everybody, but everybody comes in, dead-eyed and puke-white, and with their face hanging down around their knees, and with a well-thumbed firearm and ordnance mail-order catalog kept safe and available at home, map-wise, for when this last desperate resort of hugs and cliches turns out to be just happy horse shit for you. You're not unique, they'll say. This initial hopelessness unites every soul in this broad, cold, salad-barred hall. They are all like Hindenburg survivors. Every meeting is a reunion, once you've been in for a while. And then the palsied newcomers who totter in, desperate and miserable enough to hang in and keep coming, and start feebly to scratch beneath the unlikely insipid surface of the thing, Don Gately's found. Then get united by a second common experience. The shocking discovery that the thing actually does seem to work, does keep you substance-free. It's improbable and shocking. When Gately finally snapped to the fact, one day about 4 months into his Inniff House residency, that quite a few days seemed to have gone by without his playing with the usual idea of slipping over to Unit Number 7 and getting loaded in some non-uremic way the courts couldn't prove, that several days had gone without his even thinking of oral narcotics or a tightly rolled Dubois or a cold foamer on a hot day, when he realized that the various substances he didn't use to be able to go a day without absorbing hadn't even, like, occurred to him in almost a week, Gately hadn't felt so much grateful or joyful as just plain shocked. The idea that AA might actually somehow work unnerved him. He suspected some sort of trap, some new sort of trap. At this stage, he and the other Ennett residents, who were still there and starting to snap to the fact that AA might work, began to sit around together late at night, going batshit together because it seemed to be impossible to figure out just how AA worked. It did, yes, tentatively seem maybe actually to be working, but Gately couldn't for the life of him figure out how. Just sitting on hemorrhoid-hostile folding chairs every night, looking at nose pores and listening to cliches could work. Nobody's ever been able to figure AA out is another binding commonality. And the folks with serious time in AA are infuriating about questions starting with, how? You ask the scary old guys how AA works, and they smile their chilly smiles and say, just fine. It just works, is all. End of story. The newcomers who abandon common sense and resolve to hang in and keep coming and then find their cages all of a sudden open, mysteriously, after a while, share this sense of deep shock and possible trap. About newer Boston AAs with, like, 6 months clean, you can see this look of glazed suspicion instead of beatific glee, an expression like that of bug-eyed natives confronted suddenly with a Zippo lighter. And so this unites them, nervously, this tentative assemblage of possible glimmers of something like hope. This grudging move toward maybe acknowledging that this unromantic, unhip, cliched AA thing, so unlikely and unpromising, so much the inverse of what they'd come too much to love, might really be able to keep the lover's toothy maw at bay. The process is the neat reverse of what brought you down and in here. Substances start out being so magically great, so much the interior jigsaw's missing piece, that at the start you just know, deep in your gut, that they'll never let you down. You just know it. But they do. And then this goofy slapdash, anarchic system of low-rent gatherings and corny slogans and saccharine grins and hideous coffee is so lame, you just know there's no way it could ever possibly work except for the utterest morons. And then, Gately seems to find out, AA turns out to be the very loyal friend he thought he'd had and then lost when you came in. And so, you hang in and stay sober and straight, and out of sheer hand burned on hot stove terror, you heed the improbable sounding warnings not to stop pounding out the nightly meetings, even after the substance cravings have left, and you feel like you've got a grip on the thing at last and can now go it alone. You still don't try to go it alone. You heed the improbable warnings because by now you have no faith in your own sense of what's improbable and what isn't, since AA seems, improbably enough, to be working, and with no faith in your own senses, you're confused, flummoxed, and when people with AA time strongly advise you to keep coming, you nod robotically and keep coming. And you sweep floors, and scrub out ashtrays, and fill stained steel urns with hideous coffee, and you keep getting ritually down on your big knees every morning and night asking for help from a sky that still seems a burnished shield against all who would ask aid of it. How can you pray to a God you believe only morons believe in still? But the old guys say it doesn't yet matter what you believe or don't believe. Just do it, they say. And like a shock-trained organism, without any kind of independent human will, you do exactly like you're told. You keep coming and coming nightly. And now you take pains not to get booted out of the squalid halfway house you'd at first tried so hard to get discharged from. You hang in and hang in, meeting after meeting, warm day after cold day. And not only does the urge to get high stay more or less away, but more general life quality type things, just as improbably promised at first when you'd come in. Things seem to get progressively somehow better inside for a while, then worse, then even better, then for a while worse in a way that's still somehow better, realer. You feel weirdly unblinded, which is good, even though a lot of things you now see about yourself and how you've lived are horrible to have to see. And by this time, the whole thing is so improbable and unparsable that you're so flummoxed, you're convinced, you're maybe brain damaged still at this point from all the years of substances, and you figure you'd better hang in this Boston AA where older guys who seem to be less damaged, or at least less flummoxed by their damage, will tell you in terse, simple, imperative clauses exactly what to do and where and when to do it, though never how or why. And at this point, you've started to have an almost classic sort of blind faith in the older guys, a blind faith in them born not of zealotry or even belief, but just of a chilled conviction that you have no faith whatsoever left in yourself. And now, if the older guys say jump, you ask them to hold their hand at the desired height, and now they've got you, and you're free.
135.
Another advanced basics group speaker, whose first name Gately loses in the crowd's big hello, but whose last initial is E, an even bigger guy than John L., a green card Irishman in a scally cap and Sinn Féin sweatshirt, with a belly like a swinging sack of meal and a thoroughly visible ass to back it up, is sharing his hopes experience by listing the gifts that have followed his decision to come in and put the plug in the jug and the cap on the phenermine hydrochloride bottle and stop driving long-haul truck routes in unbroken 96-hour metal-pedaled states of chemical psychosis.
136.
The rewards of his abstinence, he stresses, have been more than just spiritual. Only in Boston AA can you hear a 50-year-old immigrant wax lyrical about his first solid bowel movement in adult life.
There'd been a confirmed bull splatterer for years beyond counting. I'd been barred from fatalities at odd truck stops to Exeter and Newark for years. Twill paper and a loo at home hung in these curled sheets from twill, I tell ya. But now, one day, I'll remember it always, to awake to the day after I stood up for me 90-day chip, and were 3 months sober, and were there on the throne at home, you know. Not to put too fine a point on it, I produced as our usual, and I were so amazed as to not believe in me ears. 'Twas a sound so wonder familiar, at first, I thought I'd dropped me wallet in the loo, don't you know. I thought I'd dropped me wallet in the loo, as good as me witness. So, down I been twixt my knees, and had a look into them a loo, and couldn't believe me eyes. So, good people, I do then, I dropped to my knees, by the loo, and had a rail look. A lover's look, do you know. And friends, 'twere lovely past me poor powers to say. 'Twere a tard in Tolu, a rail tard, 'twere firm and tapered and ever so gently aged. To looked, constructed instead of sprayed. To looked as I felt in me art, God himself meant a tard to look. My friends, this tard of mine practically had a pulse. I stayed down on my knees to thank me harper, which I choose to call me Harper Good, and I've been thanking me harper on my knees ever seen, morning and night time in a Toulouse well ever seen.
The man's red leather face radiant throughout. Gately and the other white flaggers fall about, laugh from the gut, a turd that practically had a pulse, an ode to a solid dump. But the lightless eyes of certain palsied back row newcomers widen with a very private identification and possible hope, hardly daring to imagine. A certain message has been carried. Gately's biggest asset as an Ennett House live-in staffer, besides the size thing, which is not to be discounted when order has to be maintained in a place where guys come in fresh from detox still in withdrawal, with their eyes rolling like palsied cattle, and an earring in their eyelid, and a tattoo that says, "Born to be unpleasant." Besides the fact that his upper arms are the size of cuts of beef you rarely see off hooks, his big plus is he has this ability to convey his own experience about at first hating AA to new house residents who hate AA and resent being forced to go and sit up in nose pore range and listen to such limply improbable cliched drivel night after night. Limp AA looks at first, and actually limp it sometimes really is, Gately tells the new residents. And he says no way he'd expect them to believe on just his say-so, that the thing'll work if they're miserable and desperate enough to hang in against common sense for a while. But he says he'll clue them in on a truly great thing about AA. They can't kick you out. You're in if you say you're in. Nobody can get kicked out, not for any reason. Which means you can say anything in here. Talk about solid turds all you want. The molecular integrity of shit is small potatoes. Gately says he defies the new Ennett House residents to try and shock the smiles off these Boston AA's faces. Can't be done, he says. These folks have literally heard it all. Enuresis, impotence, priapism, onanism, projectile incontinence, autocastration. Elaborate paranoid delusions, the grandiosest megalomania, communism, fringe birchism, national socialist Bundism, psychotic breaks, sodomy, bestiality, daughter diddling, exposures at every conceivable level of indecency, coprophilia and phagia. 4-year white flagger Glenn Kay's personal chosen higher power is Satan, for fuck's sake. Granted, nobody in white flag much likes Ken Kay, and the thing with the hooded cape and makeup and the candelabra he carries around draw some mutters, but Glenn Kay is a member for exactly as long as he cares to hang in. So say anything you want, Gately invites them. Go to the beginner meeting at 19:30 hours and raise your shaky mitt and tell the unlacquered truth. Free associate. Run with it. Gately this morning, just after required AM meditation, Gately was telling the tat-obsessed little new lawyer guy Ewell, with the hypertensive flush and little white beard, telling him how he, Gately, had perked up considerably at 30 days clean, when he found he could raise his big mitt in beginner meetings and say publicly just how much he hates this limp AA drivel about gratitude and humility and miracles. And how he hates it and thinks it's horseshit, and hates the AAs and how they all seem like limp, smug, moronic, self-satisfied, shit-eating pricks with their lobotomized smiles and goopy sentiment, and how he wishes them all violent technicolor harm in the worst way. New Gately sitting there, spraying vitriol, wet-lipped and red-eared, trying to get kicked out, purposely trying to outrage the AAs into giving him the boot so he could quick-march back to Ennett House and tell crippled Pat Monacian and his counselor Gene M. how he'd been given the boot at AA. How they'd pleaded for honest sharing of innermost feelings and, okay, he'd honestly shared his deepest feelings on the matter of them and the grinning hypocrites, had shaken their fists and told him to screw. And but so in the meetings the poison would leap and spurt from him, and how but he found out all that these veteran white flaggers would do as a group when he, like, vocally wished them harm, was nod furiously in empathetic identification and shout with maddening cheer, "Keep coming!" And one or two flaggers with medium amounts of sober time would come up to him after the meeting and say how it was so good to hear him share, and holy mackerel could they ever identify with the deeply honest feelings he'd shared, and how he'd done them the service of giving them the gift of a real remember-when type experience, because they could now remember feeling just exactly the same way as Gately when they first came in. Only they confessed not then having the spine to honestly share it with the group. And so in a bizarre, improbable twist, they'd have Gately ending up standing there feeling like some sort of AA hero, a prodigy of vitriolic spine, both frustrated and elated. And before they bid him au revoir and told him to come back, they'd made sure to give him their phone numbers on the back of their little raffle tickets. Phone numbers Gately wouldn't dream of actually calling up. To say what, for Christ's sakes? Mud which, he found, he rather liked having in his wallet, just to carry around, just in case of who knew what. And then plus maybe one of these old Enfield native white flag guys with geologic amounts of sober time in AA, and a twisted, ruined old body, and clear, bright white eyes would hobble sideways like a crab, slowly up to Gately after a meeting in which he'd spewed vitriol, and reach way up to clap him on his big, sweaty shoulder, and say, in their phimitic smoker's croak, that,
"Well, you at least seem like a ballsy little bastard, all full of piss and vinegar and whatnot. And just maybe you'll be okay, Don G. Just maybe. Just keep coming. And if you care for a spot of advice from somebody who likely spilled more booze in his day than you've even consumed in yours, you might try to just simply sit down at meetings and relax and take the cotton out of your ears and put it in your mouth and shut the fuck up and just listen. For the first time perhaps in your life, really listen. And maybe you'll end up okay."
And they don't offer their phone numbers. Not the really old guys. Gately knows he'd have to eat his pride raw and actually request the numbers of the old, ruined, grim, calm long-timers in White Flag. The crocodiles, the less senior White Flaggers call them. Because the old twisted guys all tend to sit clustered together with hideous turd-like cigars in one corner of the Provident cafeteria, under a 16-by-20 framed glossy of crocodiles or alligators sunning themselves on some verdant riverbank somewhere. With the maybe joke legend, "Old Timers Corner," somebody had majuscule across the bottom of the photo, and these old guys cluster together under it, rotating their green cigars in their misshapen fingers and discussing completely mysterious, long, sober matters out of the sides of their mouths. Gately sort of fears these old AA guys with their varicose noses and flannel shirts and white crew cuts and brown teeth and coolly amused looks of appraisal. Feels like a kind of low-rank tribal knucklehead in the presence of stone-faced chieftains who rule by some unspoken shamanistic fiat.
137.
And so, of course, he hates them, the crocodiles, for making him feel like he fears them. But oddly, he also ends up looking forward a little to sitting in the same big nursing home cafeteria with them and facing the same direction they face every Sunday. And a little later finds he even enjoys riding at 30 kilometers per hour tops in their perfectly maintained 25-year-old sedans when he starts going along on white flag commitments to other Boston AA groups. He eventually heeds a terse suggestion and starts going out and telling his grisly personal story publicly from the podium with other members of White Flag, the group he gave in and finally officially joined. This is what you do if you're new and have what's called the gift of desperation and are willing to go to any excruciating lengths to stay straight. You officially join a group and put your name and sobriety date down on the group secretary's official roster. And you make it your business to start to get to know other members of the group on a personal basis. And you carry their numbers talismanically in your wallet. And, most important, you get active with your group, which here in Gately's Boston AA active means not just sweeping the footprinty floor after the Lord's Prayer and making coffee and emptying ashtrays of Gasper butts and ghastly, spit-wet cigar ends, but also showing up regularly at specified PM times at the White Flag Group's regular haunt. The elite, the final E's neons ballasts out, diner, next to Steve's Donuts in Enfield Center. Showing up and pounding down tooth-loosening amounts of coffee, and then getting in well-maintained crocodilian sedans, whose suspension springs Gately's mass makes sag, and getting driven, wall-eyed with caffeine and cigar fumes, and general public speaking angst, to like Lowell's Joy of Living group, or Charleston's Plug in the Jug group, or Bridgewater State Detox, or Concord Honor Farm with these guys. And except for one or two other pale, wall-eyed newcomers with the gift of utter desperation, it's mostly crocodiles with geologic sober time in these cars. It's mostly the guys that have stayed sober in White Flag for decades who still go on every single booked commitment. They go every time, dependable as death. Even when the Celtics are on spontaneous dis, they hit the old commitment trail. They remain rabidly active with their group. And the crocodiles in the car invite Gately to see the coincidence of long-term contented sobriety and rabidly tireless AA activity as not a coincidence at all. The backs of their necks are complexly creased. The crocodiles up front look into the rearview mirror and narrow their baggy, bright, white eyes at Gately in the sagging back seat with the other new guys. And the crocodiles say they can't even begin to say how many new guys they've seen come in and then get sucked back out there. Come in to AA for a while and hang in and put together a little sober time and have things start to get better head-wise and life-quality-wise. And after a while, the new guys get cocky. They decide they've gotten well, and they get really busy at the new job sobriety's allowed them to get, or maybe they buy season Celtics tickets, or they rediscover pussy and start chasing pussy. These withered, gnarled, toothless, totally post-sexual old fuckers actually say pussy. But one way or another, these poor, cocky, clueless new bastards start gradually drifting away from rabid activity in the group, and then away from their group itself, and then, little by little, gradually drift away from any AA meetings at all, and then, without the protection of meetings or a group, in time, oh, there's always plenty of time, the disease is fiendishly patient, how in time they forget what it was like, the ones that have cockily drifted. They forget who and what they are. They forget about the disease. Until, like, one day, they're at, like, maybe a Celtics-Sixers game. And the good old Fleet First Interstate Center's hot. And they think, what could just one cold foamer hurt after all this sober time, now that they've gotten well? Just one cold one. What could it hurt? And after that one, it's like they'd never stopped if they'd got the disease. And how in a month, or 6 months, or a year, they have to come back in, back to the Boston AA halls and their old group, tottering, DTing, with their faces hanging down around their knees all over again. Or maybe it's 5 or 10 years before they can get it up to get back in, beaten to shit again. Or else their system isn't ready for the recurrent abuse again after some sober time, and they die out there. The crocodiles are always talking in hushed, numb-like tones about out there. Or else worse, maybe they kill somebody in a blackout and spend the rest of their lives in MCI Walpole, drinking Raisin Jack, fermented in the seatless toilet, and trying to recall what they did to get in there, out there. Or else, worst of all, these cocky new guys drift back out there and have nothing sufficiently horrible to finish them happen at all. Just go back to drinking, 24/7/365, to not living, behind bars, undead, back in the disease's cage all over again. The crocodiles talk about how they can't count the number of guys that have come in for a while and drifted away and gone back out there and died, or not gotten to die. They even point some of these guys out, gaunt, gray, spectral men, reeling on sidewalks with all that they own in a trash bag, as the white flaggers drive slowly by in their well-maintained cars. Old emphysemic Francis G. in particular likes to slow his LeSabre down at a corner in front of some jack-legged, loose-faced, homeless fuck who'd once been in AA, then drifted cockily out, and roll down his window and yell, "Live it up!" Of course, the crocodiles dig at each other with their knobby elbows and guffaw and wheeze. They say when they tell Gately to either hang in AA and get rabidly active or else die in slime, of course, it's only a suggestion. They howl and choke and slap their knees at this. It's your classic in-type joke. There are, by ratified tradition, no musts in Boston AA. No doctrine or dogma or rules. They can't kick you out. You don't have to do what they say. Do exactly as you please, if you still trust what seems to please you. The crocodiles roar and wheeze and pound on the dash and bob in the front seat in abject AA mirth. Boston AA's take on itself is that it's a benign anarchy, that any order to the thing is a function of miracle. No regs, no musts, only love and support and the occasional humble suggestion born of shared experience. A non-authoritarian, dogma-free movement. Normally a gifted cynic, with a keen bullshit antenna, Gately needed over a year to pinpoint the ways in which he feels like Boston AA really is actually sub rosa dogmatic. You're not supposed to pick up any sort of altering substance, of course. That goes without saying. But the fellowship's official line is that if you do slip or drift or fuck up or forget and go out there for a night and absorb a substance and get all your disease's triggers pulled again, they want you to know they not only invite but urge you to come on back to meetings as quickly as possible. They're pretty sincere about this, since a lot of new people slip and slide a bit, total abstinence-wise, in the beginning. Nobody's supposed to judge you or snub you for slipping. Everybody's here to help. Everybody knows that the returning slippy has punished himself enough just being out there, and that it takes incredible desperation and humility to eat your pride and wobble back in and put the substance down again after you fucked up the first time and the substance is calling to you all over again. There's the sort of sincere compassion about fucking up that empathy makes possible, although some of the AAs will nod smugly when they find out the slippy didn't take some of the basic suggestions. Even newcomers who can't even start to quit yet and show up with suspicious flask-sized bulges in their coat pockets and list progressively to starboard as the meeting progresses are urged to keep coming, hang in, stay, as long as they're not too disruptive. Inebriates are discouraged from driving themselves home after the Lord's Prayer, but nobody's going to wrestle your keys away. Boston AA stresses the utter autonomy of the individual member. Please say and do whatever you wish. Of course, there are about a dozen basic suggestions.
138.
And of course, people who cockily decide they don't wish to abide by the basic suggestions are constantly going back out there, and then wobbling back in with their faces around their knees, and confessing from the podium that they didn't take the suggestions, and have paid full price for their willful arrogance, and have learned the hard way. But now they're back, by God, and this time they're going to follow the suggestions to the bloody letter. Just see if they don't. Gately sponsor, Francis, ferocious Francis G., the crocodile that Gately finally got out the Jews to ask to be his sponsor, compares the totally optional basic suggestions in Boston AA to, say, for instance, if you're going to jump out of an airplane, they suggest you wear a parachute. But, of course, you do what you want. Then he starts laughing until he's coughing so bad he has to sit down. The bitch of the thing is you have to want to. If you don't want to do as you're told, I mean, as it's suggested you do, it means that your own personal will is still in control. And Eugenio Martinez, over at Ennett House, never tires of pointing out that your personal will is the web your disease sits and spins in still. The will you call your own ceased to be yours as of who knows how many substance-drenched years ago. It's now shot through with the spidered fibrosis of your disease. His own experience's term for the disease is the spider.
139.
You have to starve the spider. You have to surrender your will. This is why most people will come in and hang in only after their own entangled will has just about killed them. You have to want to surrender your will to people who know how to starve the spider. You have to want to take the suggestions, want to abide by the traditions of anonymity, humility, surrender to the group conscience. If you don't obey, nobody will kick you out. They won't have to. You'll end up kicking yourself out if you steer by your own sick will. This is maybe why just about everybody in the White Flag group tries so hard to be so disgustingly humble, kind, helpful, tactful, cheerful, non-judgmental, tidy, energetic, sanguine, modest, generous, fair, orderly, patient, tolerant, attentive, truthful. It isn't like the group makes them do it. It's more like that the only people who end up able to hang for serious time in AA are the ones who willingly try to be these things. This is why, to the cynical newcomer or fresh Ennett House resident, serious AAs look like these weird combinations of Gandhi and Mr. Rogers, with tattoos and enlarged livers and no teeth, who used to beat wives and diddle daughters and now rhapsodize about their bowel movements. It's all optional. Do it or die. For instance, Gately puzzled for quite some time about why these AA meetings, where nobody kept order, seemed so orderly. No interrupting, fist cuffery, no heckled invectives, no poisonous gossip or beefs over the tray's last Oreo. Where was the hard-ass sergeant-at-arms who enforced these principles they guaranteed would save your ass? Pat Montesian and Eugenio Martinez and ferocious Francis the Crocodile wouldn't answer Gailey's questions about where's the enforcement. They just all smiled coy smiles and said to keep coming, an apothegm Gately found just as trite as easy does it. Live and let live. How do trite things get to be trite? Why is the truth usually not just but anti-interesting? Because every one of the seminal little mini-epiphanies you have in early AA is always polyesterishly banal, Gately admits to residents. He'll tell how, as a resident, right after that one Harvard Square industrial grunge post-punk, this guy whose name was Bernard but insisted on being called Plasmatron 7. Right after old Plasmatron 7 drank 9 bottles of NyQuil on the men's upstairs head and pitched forward, face first, into his instant spuds at supper and got discharged on the spot and got firemen carried by Calvin Thrust right out to Commonwealth Avenue's Green Line T-stop and Gately got moved up from the newest guy's 5-man room to take Plasmatron 7's old bunk in the less new guy's three-man room. Gailey had an epiphanic AA-related nocturnal dream he'll be the first to admit was banally trite.
140.
In the dream, Gately, in row after row of totally average and non-unique U.S. citizens, are kneeling on their knees on polyester cushions in a crummy, low-rent church basement. The basement was your average low-rent church basement, except for this dream's church basement walls were of, like, this weird, thin, clean, clear glass. Everybody was kneeling on these cheap but comfortable cushions, and it was weird because nobody seemed to have any clear idea why they were all on their knees, and there was, like, no tier boss or sergeant-at-arms type figure around coercing them into kneeling, and yet there was this sense of some compelling unspoken reason why they were all kneeling. It was one of those dream things where it didn't make sense, but did. But then some lady over to Gately's left got off her knees and all of a sudden stood up, just like to stretch. And the minute she stood up, she was all of a sudden yanked backward with terrible force and sucked out through one of the clear glass walls of the basement. And Gately had winced to get ready for the sound of serious glass, but the glass wall didn't shatter so much as just let the cartwheeling lady sort of melt right through and heeled back over where she'd melted through and she was gone. Her cushion, and then Gately notices a couple other polyester cushions in some of the rows here and there, were empty, and it was then, as he was looking around, that Gately, in his dream, looked slowly up overhead at the ceiling's exposed pipes, and could now, all of a sudden, see, rotating slow and silent through the basement, a meter above the different shaped and colored heads of the kneeling assembly, he could see a long, plain, hooked stick. Like the crook of a giant shepherd, like the hook that appears from stage left and drags bad acts out of tomato range, moving slowly above them in French curled circles, almost demurely, as if quietly scanning. And when a mild-faced guy in a cardigan happened to stand up and was hooked by the hooked stick and pulled ass over tea kettle out through the soundless glass membrane, Gately turned his big head as far as he could without leaving the cushion, and could see now, just outside the wall's clean pane, trolling with the big stick, an extraordinarily snappily dressed and authoritative figure manipulating the giant shepherd's crook with one hand and coolly examining the nails of his other hand from behind a mask that was simply the plain yellow smiley face circle that accompanied invitations to have a nice day. The figure was so impressive and trustworthy and casually self-assured as to be both soothing and compelling. The authoritative figure radiated good cheer and abundant charm and limitless patience. It manipulated the big stick in the coolly purposeful way of the sort of angler who you know isn't going to throw back anything he catches. The slow, silent stick with the hook he held was what kept them all kneeling below the baroque little circumferences of its movement overhead. One of Ennett House's live-in staffers' rotating PM jobs is to be awake and on call in the front office all night for dream duty. People in early recovery from substances often get hit with real horror show dreams, or else traumatically seductive substance dreams, and sometimes trite but important epiphanic dreams. And the staffer on dream duty is required to be up doing paperwork or sit-ups or staring out the broad bay window in the front office downstairs, ready to make coffee and listen to the residents' dreams and offer the odd practical upbeat Boston AA-type insight into possible implications for the dreamer's progress and recovery. But Gately had no need to clomp downstairs for a staffer's feedback on this one, since it was so powerfully, tritely, obvious. It had come clear to Gately that Boston AA had the planet's most remorselessly hard-ass and efficient sergeant-at-arms. Gately lay there, overhanging all four sides of his bunk, his broad, square forehead beaded with revelation. Boston AA's sergeant-at-arms stood outside the orderly meeting halls in that much-invoked out there, where exciting clubs full of good cheer throbbed gaily below lit signs with neon bottles endlessly pouring. AA's patient enforcer was always and everywhere out there. It stood casually checking its cuticles in the astringent fluorescence of pharmacies that took forged Tolwyn scripts for a hefty surcharge, in the onion light through paper shades, in the furnished rooms of strung-out nurses who financed their own cages' maintenance with stolen pharmaceutical samples, in the isopropyl reek of the storefront offices of stooped old chain-smoking MDs whose script pads were always out and who needed only to hear pain and see cash. In the home of a snot-strangled Canadian VIP and the office of an implacable Revere ADA whose wife has opted for dentures at 35. AA's disciplinarian looked damn good and smelled even better, and dressed to impress, and his blank, black-on-yellow smile never faltered as he sincerely urged you to have a nice day. Just one. And that was the first night that cynical Gately willingly took the basic suggestion to get down on his big knees by his undersized, spring-shot, Ennett House bunk and ask for help from something he still didn't believe in. Ask for his own sick spider-bit will to be taken from him and fumigated and squished. But, and plus, in Boston AA there is, unfortunately, dogma, too, it turns out. And some of it is both dated and smug. And there's an off-putting jargon in the fellowship, a psycho-babbly dialect that's damn near impossible to follow at first, says Ken Erdetti, the college boy ad exec semi-new at Ennett House, complaining to Gately at the White Flag meeting's raffle break. Boston AA meetings are unusually long, an hour and a half instead of the national hour, but here they also have this formal break at about 45 minutes where everybody can grab a sandwich, or Oreo, and a sixth cup of coffee and stand around and chat and bond, where people can pull their sponsors aside and can find some trite insight or emotional snafu that the sponsor can swiftly, privately validate, but also place in the larger imperative context of the primary need not to absorb a substance today, just today, no matter what happens. While everybody's bonding and interfacing in a bizarre system of catchphrases, there's also the raffle, another Boston idiosyncrasy. The newest of the White Flag newcomers, trying to get active in group service, wobble around with rattan baskets and packs of tickets. One for a buck and three for a fin, and the winner eventually gets announced from the podium, and everyone hisses and shouts, "Fix!" and laughs. And the winner wins a big book, or an As Bill Sees It, or a Came to Believe, which, if he's got some sober time in, and already owns all the AA literature from winning previous raffles, he'll stand up and publicly offer it to any newcomer who wants it, which means any newcomer with enough humble desperation to come up to him and ask for it, and risk being given a phone number to carry around in his wallet. At the White Flag raffle break, Gately usually stands around chain-smoking with the Ennett House residents, so that he's casually available to answer questions and empathize with complaints. He usually waits till after the meeting to do his own complaining to ferocious Francis, with whom Gately now shares the important duty of breaking down the hall, sweeping floors and emptying ashtrays, and wiping down the long cafeteria tables, which ferocious Francis G.'s function is limited because he's on oxygen, and his function consists mostly of standing there sucking oxygen and holding an unlit cigar while Gately breaks down the hall. Gately rather likes Ken Erdetti, who came into the house about a month ago from some cushy Belmont rehab. Erdetti's an upscale guy, what Gately's mother would have called a yuppie, an account executive at Vinnie and Veal's Advertising downtown, his intake form said. And though he's about Gately's age, he's so softly good-looking, in that soft, mannequinish way Harvard and Tufts schoolboys have, and looks so smooth and groomed all the time, even in jeans and a plain cotton sweater, that Gately thinks of him as much younger, totally ungrizzled, and refers to him mentally as kid. Erdetti's in the house mainly for marijuana addiction, which Gately has a hard time identifying with anybody getting in enough trouble with weed to leave his job and condo to bunk in a room full of tattooed guys who smoke in their sleep, and to work like pumping gas. Erdetti just started his 9-month humility job at the Merit Station down by North Harvard Street in Alston for 32 minimum wage hours a week. Or to have his leg be joggling like that all the time from tensions of withdrawal. From fucking grass? But it's not Gately's place to say what's bad enough to make somebody come in and what isn't. Not for anybody else but himself. And the shapely but big-time troubled new girl, Kate Gompert, who mostly just stays in her bed in the new women's five-woman room when she isn't at meetings, and is on a suicidality contract with Pat, and isn't getting the usual pressure to get a humility job, and gets to get some sort of script meds out of the men's locker every morning. Kate Gompert's counselor, Danielle S., reported at the last staff meeting that Kate had finally opened up and told her she'd mostly come in for weed, too, and not the lightweight prescription tranks she'd listed on her intake form. Gately used to treat weed like tobacco. He wasn't like some other narcotics addicts who smoked weed when they couldn't get anything else. He always smoked weed. I could always get something else and simply smoked weed while he did whatever else he could get. Gately doesn't miss weed much. The shocker type AA miracle is he doesn't much miss the Demerol either today. A hard November wind is spattering goopy sleet against the broad windows all around the hall. The Provident Nursing Home cafeteria is lit by a checkerboard array of oversized institutional bulbs overhead, a few of which are always low and give off fluttery strobes. The fluttering bulbs are why Pat Montesian and all the other photic seizure-prone area AAs never go to White Flag, opting for the Freeway Group over in Brookline, or the candy-ass Lake Street meeting up in West Newton on Sunday nights, which Pat M. bizarrely drives all the way up from her home down on the South Shore in Milton to get to hear people talk about their analysts and sobs. There is no way to account for people's taste in AA. The White Flag Hall is so brightly lit up, all Gately can see out any of the windows is a kind of shiny, drooling black against everybody's pale reflection. Miracles, one of the Boston AA terms Erdetti and the brand-new and very shaky, veiled girl resident standing over him complain they find hard to stomach. As in, "We're all miracles here," and "Don't leave 5 minutes before the miracle happens," and "To stay sober for 24 hours is a miracle." Except the brand-new girl, either Joelle V. or Joelle D., who said she'd hit the occasional meeting in the past before her bottom, and had been roundly repelled, and is still pretty much cynical and repelled. She said on the way down to Provident under Gately's direct new resident supervision, says she finds even the word miracle preferable to the constant talk about the grace of God, which reminds her of wherever she grew up, where she's indicated places of worship were often aluminum trailers or fiberboard shacks, and churchgoers played with copperheads in the services to honor something about serpents and tongues. Gately's also observed how Erdetti's also got that Tufts, Harvard way of speaking without seeming to move his lower jaw.
"It's as if it's its own country or something," Erdetti complains, legs crossed in maybe a bit of a faggy schoolboy way, looking around at the raffle break, sitting in Gately's generous shadow.
"The first time I ever talked, over at the St. E's meeting on Wednesday, somebody comes up after the Lord's Prayer and says, 'Good to hear you, I could really ID with that bottom you were sharing about and isolating. The can't and can't, it's the greenest I've felt in months hearing you.' And then gives me this raffle ticket with his phone number that I didn't ask for and says, 'I'm right where I'm supposed to be,' which I have to say I found a bit patronizing."
The best noise Gately produces is his laugh, which booms and reassures, and a certain haunted hardness goes out of his face when he laughs. Like most huge men, Gately has kind of a high, hoarse speaking voice. His larynx sounds compressed.
"I still hate the right way you're supposed to be thing,"
he says, laughing. He likes that Erdetti, sitting looks right up at him and cocks his head slightly to let Gately know he's got his full attention. Gately doesn't know that this is a requisite for a white-collar job, where you have to show you're attending fully to clients who are paying major sums, and get to expect an overt display of full attention. Gately is still not yet a good judge of anything about upscale people except where they tend to hide their valuables. Boston AA, with its emphasis on the group, is intensely social. The raffle break goes on and on. An intoxicated street guy with a venulated nose and missing incisors and electrician's tape wrapped around his shoes is trying to sing Volare up at the empty podium microphone. He is gently, cheerfully induced offstage by a crocodile with a sandwich and an arm around the shoulders. There's a certain pathos to the crocodile's kindness, his clean flannel arm around the weather-stained shoulders, which pathos Gately feels and likes being able to feel it, while he says, "But at least the good to hear you, I quit minding. It's just what they say when somebody's got done speaking. They can't say, like, good job or you spoke well, because it can't be anybody's place here to judge if anybody else did good or bad or whatnot. You know what I'm saying, Tiny Day?" Tiny Yule, in a blue suit and laser chronometer and tiny shoes, whose shine you could read by, is sharing a dirty aluminum ashtray with Nell Gunther, who has a glass eye, which she amuses herself by usually wearing so the pupil and iris face in, and the dead white and tiny manufacturer specifications on the back of the eye face out. Both of them are pretending to study the blonde false wood of the tabletop, and Ewell makes a bit of a hostile show of not looking up or responding to Gately or entering into the conversation in any way, which is his choice and on him alone, so Gately lets it go. Wade McDade has a Walkman going, which is technically okay at the raffle break, although it's not a real good idea. Chandler Foss is flossing his teeth and pretending to throw the used floss at Jennifer Belbin. Most of the Innet House residents are mingling satisfactorily. The couple of residents that are black are mingling with other blacks.
141.
The Deal Kid and Dooney Glynn are amusing themselves, telling homosexuality jokes to Morris Hanley, who sits smoothing his hair with his fingertips, pretending to not even acknowledge, his left hand still bandaged. Alfonso Parias Carbo is standing with three Alston Group guys, smiling broadly and nodding, not understanding a word anybody says. Bruce Green has gone downstairs to the men's head and amused Gately by asking his permission first. Gately told him to go knock himself out. Green has good big arms and no gut, even after all the substances, and Gately suspects he might have played some ball at some point. Kate Gompert is totally by herself at a non-smoking table over by a window, ignoring her pale reflection and making little cardboard tents out of her raffle tickets and moving them around. Glenette Henderson clutches another black girl and laughs and says, "Girl!" several times. Emil Minty is clutching his head. Jeff Day, in his black turtleneck and blazer, keeps lurking on the fringes of various groups of people, pretending he's part of the conversations. No immediate sign of Bert F. Smith or Charlotte Treat. Randy Lentz, in his cognito white mustache and sideburns, is doubtless at the payphone in the northeast corner of the Provident lobby downstairs. Len spends nearly unacceptable amounts of time either on a phone or trying to get in position to use a phone. "'Cause what I like,' Gately says to Erdetti. Erdetti really is listening, even though there's a compellingly cheap young woman in a brief white skirt and absurd black mesh stockings sitting with her legs nicely crossed. One-strap low-spike black Ferragamos, too. At the periphery of his vision, and the woman is with a large man, which makes her even more compelling. And also the veiled new girl's breasts and her hips, clefts, are compelling and distracting next to him, even in a long, baggy, loose blue sweater that matches the embroidered selvage around her veil. "What I think I like is how 'it was good to hear you' ends up like saying two separate things together." Gately's also saying this to Joelle, who, it's weird, but You can tell she's looking at you, even through the linen veil. There's maybe half a dozen or so other veiled people in the White Flag Hall tonight. A decent percentage of people in the 11-step union of the hideously and improbably deformed are also in 12-step fellowships for other issues besides hideous deformity. Most of the room's veiled AAs are women, though there is this one male, veiled, UHID guy that's an active White Flagger, Tommy S. or F., who years ago nodded out on a stuffed acrylic couch with a bottle of Ramey and a lit Tipperillo. The guy now wears UHID veils and a whole spectrum of silk turtlenecks and assorted hats and classy lambskin driving gloves. Gately's had the UHID and veil philosophy explained to him in passing a couple times, but still doesn't much get it. It seems like a gesture of shame and concealment still to him, the veil. Pat Montesian had said there's been a few other UHIDs who'd gone through Ennett House prior to the year of dairy products from the American heartland, which is when new resident Gately came wobbling in. But this Joelle Van Dyne, who Gately feels he has zero handle on yet as a person, or how serious she is about putting down substances and coming in to really get straight, this Joelle is the first veiled resident Gately's had under him as a staffer. This Joelle girl, that wasn't even on the 2-month waiting list for intake, got in overnight under some private arrangement with somebody on the house's board of directors, upscale Enfield guys into charity and directing. There'd been no intake interview with Pat at the house. The girl just showed up 2 days ago, right after supper. She'd been up at Brigham and Women's for 5 days after some sort of horrific OD-type situation, said to have included both defib paddles and priests. She'd had real luggage and this, like, Chinese portable dressing screen thing with clouds and Popeye dragons that even folded lengthwise. Took both Green and Parias Carbo to lug upstairs. There's been no talk of a humility job for her, and Pat's counseling the girl personally. Pat's got some sort of privately directed arrangement with the girl. Gately's already seen enough private-type arrangements between certain staffers and residents to feel like it's maybe kind of a character defect of Ennett House. A girl from the Brookline Young People's Group, over in a cheerleader skirt and slut stockings, is ignoring all the ashtrays and putting her extra-long gasper out on the bare tabletop 2 rows over as she laughs like a seal at something an acneed guy in a long camel hair coat he hasn't taken off and sockless leather dance shoes Gately's never seen at a meeting before, says. And he's got his hand on hers as she grinds the gasper out, something like putting a cigarette out against the wood-grain plastic table, which Gately can already see the ragged black burned divot that's formed. It's something the rankness of which would never have struck him one way or the other before, until Gately took on half the break down the hall and wipe down the tables job at ferocious Francis G.'s suggestion, and now he feels sort of propriety about the Providence tabletops. But it's not like he can go over and take anybody else's inventory and tell them how to behave. He settles for imagining the girl pinwheeling through the air toward a glass wall. When they say it, it sort of means like what you said was good for them. It helped them out somehow, he says. But plus now, also, I like saying it myself because if you think about it, it also means it was good to be able to hear you, to really hear. He's trying subtly to alternate and look at Erdetti and Joelle both, like he's addressing them both. It's not something he's good at. His head's too big to be subtle with. Because I remember for like the first 60 days or so, I couldn't hear shit. I didn't hear nothing. I just sit there and compare. I'd go to myself like, I ain't never rolled a car, I ain't never lost a wife, I never bled from the rectum. Jean would tell me to just keep coming for a while, and sooner or later I'd be able to both listen and hear. He said it's hard to really hear, but he wouldn't say what was the difference between hearing and listening, which pissed me off. But after a while I started to really hear. It turns out, and this is just for me maybe, but it turned out hearing the speaker means like all of a sudden hearing how fucking similar the way he felt and the way I felt were, out there, at the bottom, before we each came in.
Instead of just sitting here resenting being here and thinking how he bled from the ass and I didn't and how that means I'm not as bad as him yet, and I can still be out there.
One of the tricks of being a real service to newcomers is not to lecture or give advice, but only talk about your own personal experience and what you were told and what you found out personally, and to do it in a casual but positive and encouraging way. Plus, you're supposed to try and identify with the newcomer's feelings as much as possible. Ferocious Francis G. says this is one of the ways guys with just a year or two sober can be most helpful, being able to sincerely ID with the newly sick and suffering. Ferocious Francis told Gately as they were wiping down tables that if a crocodile with decades of sober AA time can still sincerely empathize and identify with a whacked-out, bug-eyed, disease-ridden newcomer, then there's something deeply fucked up about that crocodile's recovery. The crocodiles, decades sober, live in a totally different spiritual galaxy inside. One long-timer describes it as, he has a whole new, unique, interior, spiritual castle now to live in. Part of this new Joelle girl's pull for Ken Urdetti isn't just the sexual thing of her body, which he finds made way sexier, by the way, the overlarge blue coffee-stained sweater tries to downplay the body thing, without being so hubristic as to try to hide it. Sloppy sexiness pulls Urdetti in, like a well-groomed moth, to a lit window. But it's also the veil, wondering what horrific contrast to the body's allure lies, swollen or askew under that veil. It gives the pull a perverse sideways slant that makes it even more distracting. And so, Urdetti cocks his head a little more up at Gately and narrows his eyes to make his listening look terribly intense. He doesn't know that there's an abstract distance in the look that makes it seem like he's studying a real bitch of a 7-iron on the 10th rough or something. The look doesn't communicate what he thinks his audience wants it to. The raffle break is winding down as everybody starts to want their own ashtray. Two more big urns of coffee emerge from the kitchen door over by the literature table. Urdetti is probably the second biggest leg and foot joggler in present residence after Jeffrey D. Joelle Van Dyne now says something very strange. It's a very strange little moment, right at the end of the raffle break, and Gately later finds it impossible to describe it in his log entry for the PM shift. It's the first time he realizes that Joelle's voice, crisp and rich and oddly empty, her accent just barely southern, and with a strange, and it turns out Kentuckian lapse in the pronunciation of all apicals except S, is familiar in a faraway way that both makes it familiar and yet lets Gately be sure he's never once met her before, out there. She inclines the plane of her blue-bordered veil briefly toward the floor's tile. Very bad tile. Scab, colored, nauseous, worst thing about the big room by far. Brings it back up level. Unlike Urdetti, she's standing, and in flats is nearly Gately's height, and says that she's finding it especially hard to take when these earnest, ravaged folks at the lectern say they're here but for the grace of God. Except that's not the strange thing she says, because when Gately nods hard and starts to interject about it was the same for, and wants to launch into a fairly standard Boston AA agnostic soothing riff about the God in the slogan being just shorthand for a totally subjective and up-to-you higher power, and AA being merely spiritual instead of dogmatically religious, a sort of benign anarchy of subjective spirit, Joelle cuts off his interjection and says that but that her trouble with it is that but for the grace of God is a subjunctive, a counterfactual, she says, and can make sense only when introducing a conditional clause, like, for example, but for the grace of God, I would have died on Molly Notkin's bathroom floor. So that an indicative transposition like, I'm here but for the grace of God, is, she says, literally senseless. And regardless of whether she hears it or not, it's meaningless. And that the foamy enthusiasm with which these folks can say what in fact means nothing at all makes her want to put her head in a radar range at the thought that substances have brought her to the sort of pass where this is the sort of language she has to have blind faith in. Gately looks at a rectangular blue, selvaged expanse of clean linen, whose gentle rises barely allude to any features below. He looks at her and has no idea whether she's serious or not, or whacked, or trying, like Dr. Jeff Day, to erect denial-type fortifications with some kind of intellectualish showing off. And he doesn't know what to say in reply. He has absolutely nothing in his huge, square head to identify with her with, or latch onto, or say in encouraging reply. And for an instant, the Provident cafeteria seems pin-drop silent, and his own heart grips him like an infant rattling the bars of its playpen, and he feels a greasy wave of an old, an almost unfamiliar panic. And for a second it seems inevitable that at some point in his life, he's going to get high again, and be back in the cage all over again. Because for a second, the blank white veil leveled at him seems a screen on which might well be projected a casual and impressive black and yellow smiley face, grinning, and he feels all the muscles in his own face loosen and descend kneeward. And the moment hangs there, distended, until the white flag raffle coordinator for November, Glenn Kay, glides up to the podium mic in his scarlet velour caparison and makeup and candelabrum with candles the same color as the floor tile, and uses the plastic gavel to formally end the break and bring things back to whatever passes here for order for the raffle drawing. The Watertown guy with mid-level sober time, who wins the big book, publicly offers it to any newcomer who wants it, and Gately is pleased to see Bruce Green raise a big hand, and decides he'll just turn it over and ask ferocious Francis G. for feedback on subjunctives and countersexuals. And the infant leaves its playpen alone inside him. And the rivets of the long table his seat's attached to make a brief distressed noise as he sits and settles in for the second half of the meeting, asking silently for help to be determined, to try to really hear, or die trying. New New York City's harbors Liberty Island's gigantic lady as the sun for a crown, and holds what looks like a huge photo album under one iron arm, and the other arm holds aloft a product. The product is changed each 1st of January by brave men with pitons and cranes. But it's funny what they'll find funny, AAs at Boston meetings, listening. The next advanced basics guy summoned by their gleaming bald Western Wear chairman to speak is dreadfully, transparently unfunny. Painfully new, but pretending to be at ease, to be an old hand, desperate to amuse and impress them. The guy's got the sort of professional background where he's used to trying to impress gatherings of persons. He's dying to be liked up there. He's performing. The white flag crowd can see all this. Even the true morons among them see right through the guy. But this is not a regular audience. A Boston AA is very sensitive to the presence of ego. When the new guy introduces himself and makes an ironic gesture and says, "I'm told I've been given the gift of desperation. I'm looking for the exchange window." It's so clearly unspontaneous, rehearsed, plus commits the subtle but cardinal message offense of appearing to deprecate the program rather than the self, that just a few polite titters resound, and people shift in their seats with a slight but signal discomfort. The worst punishment Gately's seen inflicted on a commitment speaker is when the host crowd gets embarrassed for him. Speakers who are accustomed to figuring out what an audience wants to hear and then supplying it find out quickly that this particular audience does not want to be supplied with what someone else thinks it wants. It's another conundrum Gately finally ran out of cerebral steam on. Part of finally getting comfortable in Boston AA is just finally running out of steam in terms of trying to figure stuff like this out. Because it literally makes no sense. Close to 200 people all punishing somebody by getting embarrassed for him, killing him by empathetically dying right there with him, for him, up there at the podium. The applause when this guy's done has the relieved feel of a fist unclenching, and their cries of "keep coming" are so sincere, it's almost painful. But then, in equally paradoxical contrast, have a look at the next advanced basic speaker. This tall, baggy sack of a man, also painfully new. But this poor bastard here completely and openly nerve-wracked. Wobbling his way up to the front, his face shiny with sweat and his talk full of blank cunctations and disassociated leaps. As the guy speaks with terrible, abashed chagrin about trying to hang on to his job out there, as his AM hangovers became more and more debilitating, until he finally got so shaky and aphasic, he just couldn't bear to even face the customers who come knocking on his department's door. He was, from 0800 to 1600 hours, the complaint department of Filene's department store.
What I did finally... Jesus, I don't know where I got such a stupid idea from. I brought this hammer in from home and brought it in and kept it right under my desk on the floor. And when somebody knocked at the door, I just sort of dive onto the floor and crawl under the desk and grab up the hammer. And I'd start into pounding on the leg of the desk real hard, like, you know, whack-a-whack-a, like I was fixing something down there. And if they opened the door finally and came in anyhow, or came in to bitch about me not opening the door, I'd just stay out of sight under there pounding away like hell, and I'd yell out I was going to be a moment, just a moment. Yeah. Emergency repairs. Be with them momentarily. I guess you can guess how all that pounding felt, you know, under there, with that big head I had every morning. I'd hide under there and pound with the hammer till they finally gave up and went away. I'd watch from under the desk and tell when they finally went away, for I could see their feet from under the desk. And about how the hiding under the desk and pounding thing worked, incredibly enough, for almost the whole last year of his drinking, which ended around this past Labor Day, when one vindictive complainant finally figured out where in Filene's to go to complain about the complaint department. The white flaggers all fell about. They were totally pleased and amused. The crocodiles removed their cigars and roared and wheezed and stomped both feet on the floor and showed scary teeth. Everyone, roaring with identification and pleasure. Even this, though, as the speaker's confusion at their delight openly betrays, the story wasn't meant to be one bit funny. It was just the truth. Gately's found it's got to be the truth is the thing. He's trying hard to really hear the speakers. He stayed in the habit he'd developed as an innate resident of sitting right up there where he could see dentition and pores, with zero obstructions or heads between him and the podium. So the speaker fills his whole vision, which makes it easier to really hear, trying to concentrate on receiving the message instead of brooding on that odd old dark moment of aphasic terror with his veiled, like, pseudo-intellectual type girl, who was probably just in some sort of complex denial, or on whatever doubtlessly grim place he feels like he knows that smooth, echoless, slightly southern voice from. The thing is, it has to be the truth to really go over here. It can't be a calculated crowd pleaser, and it has to be the truth unslanted, unfortified, and maximally unironic. An ironist in a Boston AA meeting is a witch in church. Irony-free zone. Same with sly, disingenuous, manipulative pseudo-sincerity. Sincerity with an ulterior motive is something these tough, ravaged people know and fear. All of them trained to remember the coyly sincere, ironic, self-presenting fortifications they'd had to construct in order to carry on out there under the ceaseless neon bottle. This doesn't mean you can't pay empty or hypocritical lip service, however. Paradoxically enough, the desperate, newly sober white flaggers are always encouraged to invoke and pay empty lip service to slogans they don't yet understand or believe. For example, easy does it, and turn it over, and one day at a time. It's called fake it till you make it, itself an oft-invoked slogan.